watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, the third installment of the year-long collaborative educational project on the Onondaga Nation's lawsuit to regain their ancestral lands, guaranteed to them by several treaties made over the centuries, first with European colonial governments and then the newly formed United States. The collaborative educational project, sponsored by the Onondagas, the neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, a community group, and Syracuse University, is bringing together Onondaga, academics, and community members to understand the history, culture, and role that the Six Nations of Haudenosaunee, also known as the Iroquois Confederacy, have had on the United States, and the effect of the United States on the Haudenosaunee and other indigenous nations. This history has been taught to generations of school children in a heavily biased way. Unquestioned were the rights of the so-called founding fathers, pilgrims, colonists, pioneers to do what they did, which was wage a genocidal land grab on an innocent people. Manifest Destiny, the doctrine used to justify this, was presented, during my education at least, as a positive development leading to American greatness. This series of programs will present, finally, the other side of the story. Apropos of the indoctrination of American school children, I recently heard a broadcast of a debate between neocon thought policeman David Horowitz and Native American Studies professor Ward Churchill. Horowitz, who led the charge to purge dissident perspectives on American society from public media in the 1990s, has now turned his attention to academia, the last place where one can hear, in some courses at least, critical analysis of the politics, policies, and economics of America past and present. Horowitz is on a crusade. He calls it, in typical right-wing doublespeak fashion, one for academic freedom. That freedom being that of the right wing, not to have to hear its cherished beliefs challenged, ridiculed, or debunked. To do so, according to Horowitz, is to engage in indoctrination. Whereas the crap I was force-fed as a student, liberty and justice for all, manifest destiny, and the equation of capitalism with freedom, as one might expect, is not considered to be indoctrination by Horowitz. Well, it is. And I have spent my whole life trying to learn the truth about things. Learning the truth can be painful, though, if you are or try to be an ethical person who also wants to feel good about who they are. We're barraged from all sides by pronouncements of the greatness and goodness and freeness of America. No one can run for political office without such obligatory pronouncements, which, by the way, one doesn't hear so excessively in other countries' political discourse, or at least where I've been. This national mantra, I am sorry to say, covers up a monstrous story of greed, murder, lies, treachery, cruelty. I think we must face up to this in order to make the future possible and the present bearable. I loved that nice story about the land of the free and the home of the brave. To make it so, we must first be brave enough to face the truth, brave enough to make reparations, and brave enough to be full equals and treat others as such. Maybe then we might actually be a land of the free. What you're about to hear is a recording made last Tuesday that contains one of the most amazing teachers I have ever had the privilege to hear, Onondaga Beaver Clan Chief Irving Paulus Jr., who seized the time and, after the formal presentation was concluded, led the audience in an exercise to make them understand the meaning of the Onondaga land claim in a personal way. Fasten your seatbelts.
I am Richard Loader, Director of Native American Studies at Syracuse University, and I am pleased to welcome you this evening to The Onondaga Nation Encounters European Settlers, 1600 to 1794. This is our third presentation of the year of a year-long collaborative educational series bringing together the Central New York community, Syracuse University, and the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. We have two outstanding speakers, panelists today. Our first speaker will be Chief Irving Paulus, Jr. Chief Paulus has been the leader of the Onondaga Nation Beaver Clan for over 35 years. He has played a leading role in raising treaty obligations to state and federal officials and was instrumental in having sacred objects and wampum belts in various museums returned to the Onondaga Longhouse. Chief Paulus's most recent publication is a chapter in the Treaty of Canandaigua, 1794. He has appeared in several films, including The Trail of Tears, 500 Nations, The Reawakening, and he continues to do his scholarly work as well as his community activities. Our second speaker this evening is Robert W. Venables. Professor Venables is a senior lecturer for Cornell University's American Indian Studies program, where his course in American Indian Studies attracts hundreds of students each year. The former curator of the American Indian History of American Indian History at the Museum of the American Indian, Dr. Venables' most recent publications is the two-volume set American Indian History, Five Centuries of Conflict and Coexistence. He is also the editor of the Six Nations of New York, co-editor of American Indian Environments, Ecological Issues, and Native American History, and a contributing author to Exiles in the Land of the Free, collective study of the Haudenosaunee influence on pre- and post-colonial America. Thank you.
Siguli.
Yamahaskanyo. This is something new for Bob and I. We have lectured many times in the various schools and colleges, universities around the area, but usually separately. And to do this together is something new. I don't know how it's going to work. This is totally unrehearsed, and you are welcome to laugh anytime when we don't do it right. But tonight, according to the notice that I got, we're going to cover a few years of history from 1600 to today. And we got a couple hours to do it, so hang on to your hat because we're going to be traveling about 95 miles an hour. We're going to have to skim over a lot of the history because of time. There are a lot of volumes written about the Haudenosaunee, and time does not allow us to really go into the history. But when we first was asked to do this, Bob and I talked with Bob. He said, "Yeah, let's do that. It sounds like it's fun." I said, "Okay." So I said, "Well." So I started thinking about, "Well, how are we going to do this?" You know, I said, "Well, 400 years of history in one evening. Well, how do we do that?" So I says, "Well, Bob, let's start this way." And so he said, "Okay." So, and I usually do not have a piece of paper when I lecture. I lecture at Cornell, and Bob will, I go up there and lecture from 7:30 until 9. And when I come to his house at 7:20, he says, "Irv, this is your topic." I said, "Okay." And I got 10 minutes to prepare. And I present for a couple hours without a paper, just the history of the Haudenosaunee, oral history, that is. And so I'd like to give you, so as we talked about this, I said, "Well, let's make a presentation about our meetings and what happens when him and I sit down." And he said, "All right." Let's make a list of starting at 1600s and go down through and list various points in history, and we'll talk about those. He said, okay. So he went home and drew up an outline of topics that we can talk about. Give it to me and says, how's this, Herb? I said, well, it's a start. We cover page first half of page we can cover in the first hour. So we'll go down through and we'll note these various events in history. But to start off with, I want to tell you what happened or why we were picked to do this. My wife and I were sitting at having lunch one day. There's a knock on the door. I said, come in. And Bob Venables walked into my house. He introduced himself and told me he was a history teacher at Oswego. And I said, well, sit down. I said, let's talk about history. And so this was the first meeting of 36 years of meetings. We've been sitting together for 36 years talking about what has happened in the state of New York with the state officials and the Haudenosaunee leaders. And he says, well, tell me about your history. So he starts telling me about the history. And I said, no, that's wrong. What do you mean that's wrong? I said, it's not the right history. Let me tell you what the history is like. So I tell him what the history was like, and he says, never heard of that. And I said, well, that's our history, Bob. And this is how we think, this is what we say, and this is the way history is according to us. So from that meeting, he went back to Oswego, took in these books, checked out, done some research, and found out that what I was saying in my oral history was recorded in the archives of the state of New York's literature research, historians had written. And I said, well, we got to talk some more. I like this idea because right now I'm my father, and I sat for years talking about history, treaties, and so forth. Then I sat in the council, as Dick said, I was in there for 35 years. I've been sitting there. And when the elders are telling me about treaty obligations and so forth, I said, well, let me look these up. So I went to the library, and in a cabinet that was locked, I found the treaties. They wouldn't let me take them out. They just let me look at them. So I talked to a friend of mine, and I said, look, there's treaties out there somewhere. I need copies of them. So my friend went to various libraries, and finally, I started getting a collection of papers, and then I read the treaties, and I said, wow, these treaties are nowhere near what my elders are telling me. So I went to the longhouse at Onondaga, and I said, these treaty obligations that you've been telling me all these years are not written down that way in the treaties. They're not. I said, no, did you ever read these? Nope. I said, well, let me read these to you. And so I read the treaties, and he says, wow, that ain't right. I said, well, yeah, that's true. I said, so we have to do something about this. And they said, right. What do we do? I said, well, we're going to have to educate the people about the true history of the Haudenosaunee state of New York. So again, this started my voyage to the various colleges and universities. And his voyage from Oswego to my place. And so for 36 years, we've been sitting here discussing the history of the state of New York. From my point of view and his point of view, and funny too, because he would say, well, this is the way history is, Irvin. And I said, no, that's incorrect. This is the way it is. And he says, no, that's not right. So we'd argue back and forth. And then he would go back and he would check his books. He'd come back. He says, Irv, he says, you're right, which made me feel pretty good. And then we got into the real nitty-gritty of history. And he started changing his history from what was written to the oral history of the Onondagas and the Haudenosaunee. And this was to the delight of Oswego. They were so delighted that they fired him. And then he went down to New York. He worked with the Smithsonian Institute down there and continued on with the education and the history of the Haudenosaunee according to Herb Powis. This, of course, was delighted by them also. So they fired him from that job. I know this is a very serious matter, but there are a lot of funny incidents that have happened. And so we'll be telling those as we go through. And we have a picture of him and I, or I have a picture of him and I, that I asked for, and he sent to me a couple of weeks ago. At Cornell, they set up a residence hall for Native students, and he wanted to integrate Natives and students that were going to Cornell. So they had a big project going. They built this residence hall. They gave it a Mohawk name, Akwigong, or something like that. They did it in a theme of treaty belts, purple and white, and then invited me down there to help with the opening of this residence hall. And Cornell, in all their wisdom, decided I could give 300 years of history to those that were there in 3 minutes. So I had 3 minutes to prepare this, and in front of this where we were was a big oak tree. And for the event, Bob had dressed up as Thomas Jefferson. So he had his coat, tails, a white shirt, knickers and white socks, buckled shoes. And, of course, I was there in my full regalia, feathers, beadwork moccasins, and so forth. And we stood underneath the spreading oak tree and had our picture taken. And I said to Bob later, I said, well, it looks like Gunasatega was talking to Thomas Jefferson under the spreading oak tree. It's a terrific picture, but though it was only taken a few years ago, it's a reflection of back 300-400 years ago when our leaders were meeting with the founding fathers of the Constitution of the United States. Anyway, I know I keep telling these sad stories that are kind of funny because my friend here says, you sure taught me a lot. And he says, I keep telling people these things. I keep getting fired. I'll tell you something else. In 1966, as a spokesman for the Onondaga Nation against the state of New York Taxation Department, I was out speaking on behalf of the nation and our status as non-taxable people. I know that we have, in our territory anyway, we've always had freedom of speech. And this became part of your Bill of Rights and your Constitution of the United States, where you have freedom of speech. And so I felt very confident, you know, that I could go out there and I could speak on behalf of the Onondaga Nation, because it's my privilege and my right to be able to do this. So that's what I was doing. Bob was sitting with me, you know. He came in 1970, after I'd been through this time period. But IRS didn't like what I was saying, I guess. IRS, as I understand it, periodically or at random, will pick names out and audit your income tax returns. Is that correct? I was randomly picked 8 years in a row. I filed in April. I got my return back in November. Now, this happened way back in the 60s. And a couple of weeks ago, Bob and I were sitting there talking, and we went back to the 60s, and I was telling him about what happened to me when I was speaking for and on behalf of the Onondagas on taxation. He says, do you know that I was randomly picked also? I said, you were. He said, the IRS came after me. He says, they audited my income tax. So freedom of speech is okay, I guess, as long as you're saying the same thing that's going on in Washington, D.C. I tell you that so that you're aware that there's consequences to being a speaker for your community or whoever. If it's against the policy of the United States, they just may come after you. Last week I was talking to Bob about the things that have gone on in Onondaga and surrounding territories. People come to us for help. And the people in Newfoundland had a problem with their fishing, and Newfoundland was coming after the natives and telling them they couldn't fish. Those people, the Mi'kmaqs, came down on a dog and told us that what was going on, could we help? We said, sure, we can help. So we sent people up there to see what was going on. While we were there, contact point was made. Orrin Lyons was one of those that we sent up there. So he said, well, you can contact me. And they said, terrific. So they came back, and wasn't too sure how we're going to do all this stuff, but Orrin went down and see Bob. He said, Bob, I got some messages coming through from the Mi'kmaqs. I wonder if you could take them and then forward it on to me. He says, because I think that our phones are tapped. So Bob says, sure, I can do that. So a couple days later, the phone rings. Bob answers the phone. Hello, this is Mi'kmaqs up at Newfoundland. We got a message for the Onondagas. So Bob says, all right, give me the message. So he took the message, and then he had a number to call. I think it was Orange number. Dial the number, and it gets all kinds of noises on the phone. And finally some guy says, hello, this is Station 6. And Bob says, well, listen, you better keep quiet about Station 6 if you want to hear what the message is. So Bob gave him the message, and he just didn't understand what the message was or what it meant. He said, I hope Orrin got it. I said, I haven't seen Orrin since Bob told me this, to see whether he ever got the message, but our phones were tapped. And one of the things that I have said to those that come to us, not only Native people, but Europeans come to us for help. And I tell them, I said, well, pay attention to what goes on in Indian Territory. And right now, they got their guns pointed at us. And if we don't get a big outcry from the mass media that this is not right, they're going to turn their guns on. They're going to be facing you. They're going to be coming at you next. And they say, yeah. Then they're back 10 years later, and they say, geez, we should listen to you, because what happened to you has now happened to us. I give you an example of that. In 1971, New York State decided, the Transportation Department decided to put another lane up on 81. And we said, no, you can't do that. They said, well, we have a contract with you. I said, well, show us the contract. They showed us the contract. The contract says two lanes going south, two lanes going north. It doesn't say nothing about a third lane going up there. I said, well, we'll give you $10,000 to do that. We'll give you $10,000 more to put the other lane in. I said, no, our land is not for sale. You can't do that. Anyway, we spent the whole summer up on Route 81 arguing with the Transportation Department about this third lane they wanted to put in. The Sheriff's Department went down to Utica, and they got a judge down there to make a ruling. And the judge ruled that the Onondagas could not go up on Route 81 and protect their own property, their territory. They restricted us from going up on 81. And so we met, and the Onondaga Council says, well, we're going to have to fix this. Irv, go to New York and talk to the lawyers. And I said, all right. So I went down to New York, and I talked to Omar Gabashi, an Egyptian, and I told him what had happened, and the courts had ruled without us ever being in court. He said, well, that's not right. Who is this guy? I said, I don't know, some judge up in Utica. So Omar found out who he was, called him up and said, you made a decision against the Onondagas without the Onondagas being in court. They had to have their day in court. Open it up. So the judge okayed it, and Omar went up there and explained, stopped in at Onondaga. We told him what we wanted him to say. He went up to Utica and talked to the judge. The judge reversed his decision of what he had done before, and this time he ruled that New York State Department of Transportation did not have the power of eminent domain in the territory of the Onondagas, and they were to cease their work and to remove themselves from the territory. And I said, wow, what a decision that is. That's a terrific decision. New York State laws do not come into our territory, especially eminent domain. And I said, so those people from the city of Syracuse should have been up there on 81 with us, but they weren't. Now guess what? The year is 2006. I understand that there's an eminent domain project in the city of Syracuse? Well, we told you. Anyway, for this first half a page here, I'm going to turn this over to Bob Venables and let him go down, because this guy, I've listened to him talk. Yeah, I've heard it for the last 36 years. He's just too amazing. It amazed me on the figures and the information that he has. And he tells about history. And I want you to know that what you're going to hear tonight is something that you haven't heard before, probably haven't read about. You only read about it if you're doing research, or you know what books to find, or he gives you a list of books. Just look at these things. We got people like Bob Venables and Larry Huttman, who have written about what has happened to the Haudenosaunee and the relationship with the state of New York. Larry's last book is Conspiracy of Interest. And he explains how the state of New York intimidated and coerced the various nations of the Haudenosaunee to make treaties and give up their land. So-called treaties, because the Constitution of the United States says they can't do that. Anyway, I'll turn it over to Bob and let him come down to various historical points, whereas the state of New York and the Haudenosaunee or the Onondagas met and discussed various issues.
Thank you, Arv. Good evening. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm grateful to share the stage with my friend of 36 years. I think I should point out that the first 3 years, from 1970 to about 1973, I didn't agree with her. We did argue because I had been told in my PhD program certain aspects of history. I knew my documents, I thought. And he would say, well, that's not how I see it. And I said, well, I've never seen that evidence. And so I spent those 3 years changing my worldview, and also going out into documents that hadn't been searched. And I came to the conclusion that what has happened is selective history on the part of the white males who dominate the writing of history. They don't study all the documents. They don't study the complete Constitutional Convention. They don't study all the papers that are available to them. For example, General Thomas Gage was the British general in charge of sending the troops to Lexington and Concord to start the revolution. He is the British general that sent the troops up Bunker Hill. Stationed in Boston during the American Revolution, since 1763, he had also been in charge of American Indian affairs, both in the southern colonies and the northern colonies. He had extensive correspondence with Superintendent Sir William Johnson in New York. And during the American Revolution, when they lost Boston, General Gage packed up his papers, tied them with red tape, which is the expression we get, cutting through the red tape, tied them up with red tape, and shipped them back to England. Scholars read those papers as they related to the political factions of patriots and loyalists and neutrals of the white persuasion. I was the first scholar to look at the papers that he wrote on American Indians. And we would unwrap now faded packs of documents, the curators and I, these faded ribbons, these faded red tapes. We'd open them up, and we'd open up the documents. Now, in the 18th century, one of the ways you blotted your letter was you sprinkled sand on it, and then you knocked the sand off, and the sand fell off the page, and that blotted the ink. But after more than two centuries, tiny grains of sand had still stuck to the ink back in the 1760s and 1770s. But now, when I was reading them in the 20th century, this sand was no longer adhering to the ink. And at the end of every day of going through these documents, I had a little pile of 18th century sand at the end of my desk. And the curator knew I was interested in the red tape. He says, "You want one of those red tapes?" I said, "Oh, yeah." So I have that red tape. All right, now look, if this guy is in charge of Indian affairs in the 1760s and the 1770s, he's the British official reporting to the crown. If we haven't read his papers, what haven't we read? And every time Irv would say something, I would say, "Well, I don't understand that, but I will keep looking." And I remember one time in the early 70s, he told me something. He said, "This is what we think." I said, "Irv, I couldn't testify to that in court." But in 1977, I found what he was looking for. And I was really excited because I believed him that his viewpoint was valid. I just needed to see it for myself. Because in the white court system, as you probably already know, oral testimony of oral tradition doesn't count unless you can back it up with documentary evidence, P.S., written by white people. So everything that Irv has taught me in terms of Haudenosaunee worldview, Onondaga worldview, I am confident in looking at even the most skeptical of you and saying, I can prove from a white point of view that what he is saying is right. Because in every generation, there have always been, unfortunately, a minority, but there has always been a minority of white people who understand what is right versus what is expedient. And they have interviewed people and they have written letters. For example, in 1815, at the end of the War of 1812, the United States Senate was debating the Treaty of Ghent. The Treaty of Ghent is a major keystone of American Indian law and Haudenosaunee law in the sense that it says that every right that an American Indian had prior to the start of the War of 1812, they have after the War of 1812, whether they were neutral, pro-British, or pro-United States. Every right is intact. The United States demolishes this for many people during removal. But during the debates over the Treaty of Ghent in the United States Senate, the United States Senator from New York, Rufus King, who was one of the 55 white men who wrote the Constitution, whose notes are regarded as the most accurate reflections of what the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia was all about. Why isn't James Madison's notes regarded as the most extensive? Because in 1987, James Hudson, a historian, proved without a doubt that towards the end of his life, James Madison altered his notes to fit the crime, to fit what he wanted people to think went on in the Constitutional Convention. That meant Rufus King is the valid observer of the Constitutional Convention. He stands up in the United States Senate, and he reviews Indian rights. Now, he's a senator from New York. He's a Federalist. He's a conservative. He's not a liberal. He stands up in the United States Senate, and he gives this long speech, the last phrase of which is, with regard to American Indians, quote, "The sovereignty of the United States is not absolute." Now, Governor Pataki isn't referring to Rufus King. President Bush, assuming he could even find a reference to Rufus King, isn't talking about Rufus King. And I don't mean to just pick on the Republicans because Clinton is no better. Every Democrat, every Republican who's been president has nailed American Indians to the wall. And it really doesn't matter who it was. Because we're a democracy and it's majority rule. And the presidents realize that, hey, we're not going to get anywhere if we support this tiny minority of less than 2% of the population. Okay, so my premise is that everything I'm saying that you might think is pro-Irv Palace version is actually based on my own research and in documents that I can support whatever it is that Irv has taught me these 36 years, because that's what the white court system insists on. The white court system insists that it have the testimony has substance, not just from oral tradition, but also from the white documents. For those of you who are young and are studying in graduate school or undergraduate school, I think one of the things that you should be encouraged about is that people who live in an oral tradition can be depended on to direct you toward the right ideas. And don't think that just because it's an oral tradition, it might be a little loose on the facts. Also, you should use James Madison, who later becomes president, you should use James Madison as an evidence that the documents aren't always telling the truth either. That you can alter the documents, or you can release them and pretend that it's a breach of national security. See, it depends on who's sitting in the chair. Well, okay, here we go. This is the dates. These are the dates that you've got to remember. Are you ready? Here we go. 1142, 1492, 1524, 1613, 1677, 1744, sorry, 1768, 1784, 1794. Thank you very much. That's all you need to know. If you know those dates, you've got it nailed. Let's go back. 1142 is, of course, pre-European contact, but it is the founding of the Confederacy and the establishment of the Confederacy based on new spiritual messages, but also based on the traditions that had existed before, the spiritual messages that had existed before. So the Confederacy reaches back in terms of time well beyond 1142 in the sense of its culture, in the sense of its spirituality. 1142. 1492, quoted by that supposed liberal, that Democrat in the Supreme Court. What's her name? Nice person. She wrote the Sherrill decision. Ginsburg. She justified the occupation of the United States on Indian land by the right of discovery. That has got to be the most obscene idea. But think of that. The right of discovery. Okay, that's 1492. You think about how obscene that is. And we'll move right along. We'll go to 1524. 1524. A smallpox or perhaps other epidemic had broken out in 1520 in Florida because Spanish conquistadors were raiding the coast of Florida for slaves to take them back to the Caribbean. They inadvertently introduced smallpox and other epidemic diseases in 1520. By 1524, those epidemic diseases are in western New York, in Seneca country, because of the Indian trade routes. Indians are dying in western New York of white diseases introduced accidentally from the Caribbean because Indian trade routes are so efficient, they're bringing stuff up from Florida to western New York. So by the time Cartier arrives in 1534 up in the St. Lawrence, the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois people, and other Indian people are already under the attack of horrible diseases. 1613 is the date of the Tuorowombam. 1613 is the date when there is an agreement between the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee to take separate paths but share the same physical space, a philosophical concept which is certainly useful throughout history. In 1677, there's a Silver Covenant chain belt, the first agreement that we know of with the state of New York. The Silver Covenant chain establishes an economic and spiritual and political link, the Silver Covenant chain of 1677. 1744, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Canisateo, stands up and suggests to Ben Franklin and others at the Treaty of Lancaster that the colonies should unite as the Haudenosaunee do. 1768, are you listening, conservatives? Are you listening, Governor Pataki? I know you're not listening, George, but maybe Gonzalez is listening. In 1768, the colonial government of the British under Sir William Johnson that was responsible for Indian affairs, reported to Gage, who's coordinating all of this, and he's going to report back to the Crown in London, that they're going to establish a treaty called the First Treaty of Fort Stanwyck, 1768, with the specific goal of separating the Haudenosaunee from the state of New York and establishing the western boundary. Are you listening, Governor Pataki? The western boundary of the colony of New York. And the Treaty of Fort Stanwyck is put through. And the Treaty of Fort Stanwyck ends the colony of New York at Rome, New York. That's how it stands at the time of the American Revolution. That's how it stands when the American Revolution breaks out. You can find this in Gage's papers. You can find this in the Sir William Johnson papers. There is no doubt about it. The British government stops the expansion of the colony of New York to preserve peace with native people and establishes that boundary. Now we jump to 1779. The Sullivan Campaign, which devastates over 40 towns in Cayuga and Seneca country, starts in August of 1779, but it's preceded by an event which the Onondagas know all too well and about which I wish more was known among the non-Indian public of Syracuse and New York State. On April 21st, Colonel Goose Van Schaack led an army of patriots, including the 3rd New York, and attacked and destroyed Onondaga towns. During that attack, his orders had been from James Clinton to avoid rape. Clinton said, "Bad as the savages are," that's a quote, "bad as the savages are," unquote, "they do not rape," which is true. So Van Schaack went in to Onondaga, and they slaughtered civilians. And then the soldiers gang-raped young Onondaga women. Gang-raped them. And then butchered them. Butchered them. And at the close of the American Revolution, one of the Onondaga leaders was talking to the British officer at Fort Niagara. And this Onondaga leader said that his people would never forget this. And this event was carried out by what he called, quote, Christians. Christians. Militant Christianity has a cruel, cruel history. And you do not have to go to the Middle East and study the Crusades to find out how militant Christianity can be brutally cruel, because the Van Schaack campaign demonstrates that. The Sullivan campaign demonstrates that. 1784, Treaty of Fort Stanwyck ends the war between the Haudenosaunee and the United States because the United States can't afford to continue the war. The revolution is over, but the revolution treaty, the Treaty of Paris, is made only between the subjects of the Crown, George III, and the citizens of the United States. And in 1784, Native people are not citizens of the United States. They're not in the treaty at all. 1794, after a whole series of interesting legislation and negotiations, not the least of which are illegal negotiations carried out by, hello, Governor Pataki, the state of New York, the Treaty of Canandaigua is passed. In negotiations with the Haudenosaunee, the George Washington government makes a treaty in which the obligations of both sides are mutual, and the resolution of conflict will be conducted between the Haudenosaunee and the President of the United States or his representative. It is a mutual treaty. That's what you need to know quickly. And there are a lot of gaps in that, and I hope during the question and answer session, if you feel that you would like to fill in some of those gaps or more of those details. We only have a short amount of time, but I wanted to go over those at least crucial points. And I see Irv has something that relates to 1613. So
Before we go there, though, I'd like to go back to 1142.
Oh, okay.
With the formation of the Confederacy. Confederacy is a word that's used today, and it's used by the English after the United States Constitution came into effect, and history gets written down in the words of, the day, of that day. When the five nations, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, Onondagas, the Cuyahogas, and the Senecas came together in 1142, we did not form a confederacy. We formed the Haudenosaunee. There is no Onondaga word for confederacy. But we formed a union of five nations together and pledged that we would live from this day forward in peace. And this we have done. Mohawks and the Onondagas have not been at war with each other since for 1142. There's been disagreements between individuals, but as nations, we have not fought against each other. There's much to be learned on how we as a people can learn to coexist from our elders. And so when the Europeans came over into our territory in the dates that Bob mentioned and settled, they came into what is now known as New York. They came up the Hudson River, settled in what is now Albany, Rensselaer, Troy, New Amsterdam, Rotterdam. Wonder where they're getting these names from. These were the Dutch people that were coming up into our territory. They came into our territory, and we, as I said, we did not form a confederacy. Did not form a confederacy. We formed, or what was formed was Haudenosaunee, people of the Long House. Our house extended from Mohawk territory into Seneca territory. Each one of us with our own little rooms in the house. And in the center of this house was the Onondagas, the firekeepers of this long house. And we still are the firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee. When all the nations meet together to discuss issues, they meet at Onondaga, at the long house of the Onondagas. We watched as these people came into our territory, or the Mohawks did, wondered who they were and what they were doing in our house. So a messenger was sent to Onondaga to inform us of what was going on, that something should be done about it. So a meeting was held at Onondaga, and we, under the process and procedure that was laid down in 1142 by the peacemakers, to how we will meet, how we will greet each other, how we will conduct ourselves, all laid down way back then. And the process and procedure that was laid down then laid the foundation for us today to say we are sovereign people. It's tough to sit and go through this line of history without jumping around. I've never been able to do this anyway. I tried it once before. I got so lost. I didn't know where I was. I ended up talking for 3 hours on one sentence. I kept going over the same thing over and over again. Anyway, the Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse were looking at these people that were moving into their house. And so we sent a delegation up there to talk with these people. And there they were, these people with funny clothes, hair on their face, no color in their skins, you know, they were white, they had blue eyes. We never seen people like this. And they talked funny. And so we said, somehow or other, our ancestors were able to talk with these people and found out that they had come from across the waters. And we knew that they were coming. And we did know that they were going to be destructive. What we didn't know was how destructive they were going to be. But we sat with them and said, you know, you're welcome into our house. You can live in our house under these conditions. And we laid down the conditions for these people to come into our territory. I don't know how many days we sat there and talked about how this would be, but we agreed that we would coexist, we would live together, respecting each other as people. As we know that these individuals were people, because they walked around like us, they spoke in a language we didn't understand, but they had their ways, they had their leaders, we had our leaders, so we said, well, we can live together, and this is how we will live together. We set down rules and regulations for that, of coexisting. And while this is going on, various topics are discussed. And since they had come up the Hudson River in a ship with big sails on it, and we were paddling around in a canoe, and they had guns, they had iron kettles, we had buckets made out of bark, they had silver buckles, we had deerskin, and hadn't got into metal yet. And so because they thought that they were superior, they said, well, we will meet, and you'll refer to us as father, and we'll call you son. And we said, no, that's not too good. We know what fathers can do to sons, so it has to be different than this one. From this day forward, we will call each other brother. So that was agreed upon. So when we met, we referred to each other as brothers. And they said, well, we have a way of recording these such events such as this. And we'll write this all down on a piece of paper, and a pencil and paper, and write it down. And we said, well, that's very good that you have a way of recording. So we also have a way of recording. And we will put this down in a belt. And we think that in the future, we will still have our belt, but you will not have your piece of paper, because paper is very thin. It's not very heavy. Wind will blow it away. But our belts are such that they will last forever. And so they said, all right, you recorded your way, we recorded our way. And so from 1613, when this happened, I can show you our record of that event. Where is your piece of paper? Have you ever seen it? Have you read about it? No. Well, anyway, this is a belt that is made out of white beads representing peace and truth. One of the purple rows of beads represents those people that were settling up in Albany. Represents their boat, their sail, their government, their religions, and so forth. The other row of beads represents the Haudenosaunee in their canoe, their leaders, their governments, and their way of life. It's separated by three rows of beads. The three rows of beads are peace and friendship, or peace, friendship, and the third row is forever. And not sure as how these people are going to understand forever. Our ancestors said, we'll explain forever to you. This agreement that we're going to live by will last as long as the grass is green, as long as the water flows downhill, and as long as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. I know, driving around today, I noticed that the grass is still green. The sun came up in the east this morning, and it's setting in the west at 7:30 this evening. So this agreement is still in effect. We will coexist together on Mother Earth, respecting each other as a people. We will respect the environment. We will take care of the environment. And we will never pass a law telling the other person what to do or how to live. The Haudenosaunee have never violated this. We have never told European people that in our territory how they should live, or where they could go, what they couldn't do, or what their religion should be. On the other hand, New York State and all the other states of the United States and the United States itself has written all kinds of laws that prohibit us from practicing our way of life. It stops us from going to sacred sites. I know that you people know about the Black Hills, the sacred site of the Lakotas. They are prohibited from going there to practice their ceremonies. And that's a violation of this concept and this idea. So as today in the UN, a document is trying to go through the UN for indigenous peoples, and so their rights will be recognized as a people. The word people is being challenged. The people of today are not following this concept. We recognized you when you came into our territory as a people with different ways, different concepts, different governments. And we said, well, we can work with you. We can live together in peace and harmony. But 400 years later, you've lost your paper and you don't treat the Native people as a people. Don't recognize them as someone with human rights. This has to change. And that's why I'm out here speaking about this, because the Creator gave us a mind to think. And with this mind, He said, you can sit down, and if you have a dispute, you can sit down and resolve your dispute without going to war or having fights in that kind of manner. And so I had mentioned before that the members of the member nations of the Haudenosaunee have not fought against each other all of these years. And I said, you know, we have to look at natural laws, natural world. And if we look at the animals in the woods, we see deer, bear, rabbits, pheasants, partridge, mink, muskrats, beavers, all coexisting together on Mother Earth, each one with their own separate ways and their own territory. And these are the animals of the forest. We, the brilliant species of the animal world, in all of these years have not been able to learn how to live together in peace and harmony and recognize our differences. We're always trying to change people, change boundary lines. This is not the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to recognize our differences and respect those differences, but live together in peace and harmony. And that's what this spell is about. This is not happening. When George Washington sent Sullivan into Onondaga to destroy our villages, the Haudenosaunee named him Onondagas, which means town destroyer. And every president of the United States since that time carries that name. We wrote a letter to George Bush a couple of years ago about some concerns and violations of our treaties, and we put the date on, and then we wrote Onondagas. Underneath that, we wrote President of the United States of White House, Washington, D.C., and his zip code number and so forth. Then we said, greetings, brother. But if you look at the history of your presidents of the United States and look at the name Town Destroyer, I think you will find that the name fits. It's all of these presidents, and Bob can probably tell you more about, or list the presidents that have destroyed towns and countries. And they dropped a bomb on Japan and wiped out thousands of people and a whole town, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and most recently were George Bush's into Iraq. I don't know whether you people pay attention to the news or not. I do. And sometimes these reporters are so much into the news that they don't hear the news. What's that expression? You couldn't see the forest because of the trees? On July 21st, Channel 5 makes this report. The Japanese have manufactured a new toy. They call it puppy soccer. And you can sit with this machine and run dogs around and they play soccer. And the reporter says, United States government is examining this toy to see whether the mechanism of this toy can be used in a future war.